Disclosure: the information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, any and all information presented in this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for specific individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making any decision. Hey everyone, Ben here with the Wealth Crypto Podcast again, and have another great episode for you today. This one is with Casper Sauter. He is the co-founder of Quanteno, which is essentially a development firm for crypto projects, with their main project being the D8X protocol, which is a perpetual futures DeFi protocol. Casper's background is in bulge bracket banks. He worked at UBS for a number of years on their equity research team, working pretty intensely with the models that they run at the bank. So Casper's got a pretty technical background, which obviously informs the protocol that he's working on. So hope you guys enjoy. Thanks. And we're live. Casper, thanks for joining, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I always like to start off the podcast with a little bit of an intro so the listeners can understand who you are. So maybe just give us the cliff notes on you, and then we can go from there.
Sure. I'm Casper, economist by trade. Used to research, used to work in TradFi for a while, Swiss banks at the end, and ventured into DeFi a couple of years ago. Now, basically co-founder of D8X, PERP protocol. It's like in 1 second. Short background.
that is a short background. Sometimes I ask people that question. Well, everyone gets asked that question, and some people are a little more descriptive.
Exhausted. I'm very happy to deep dive, right? I mean, if there's anything that's interesting, but basically you can think about me. I originally did a PhD in economics, so I kind of have like a quant background there. Spend a lot of time in quant roles, building quant teams in traditional banks, and was always like super fascinated by DeFi, the possibility to be able to build financial machines. So for my co-founders as well, so we decided to take the opportunity when we had it and give it a shot.
Yeah. So maybe walk us through a little bit about how you go from sort of, you know, traditional economist role inside of a bank into DeFi. What was like the idea that you guys pursued, and then practically, you know, how did you actually start the business and get going?
So the idea was always quite simple. So when I last I was at UBS, when I worked at UBS, we had like a huge compliance department, we had a huge risk department. I interacted with regulators a lot, the Fed, the Swiss regulators, the European regulators. And so you have this whole machine, which basically is there to control the bank, right? Control the middleman.
Yeah. Don't get in trouble.
once I figured out that you actually can build financial machines using code, I mean, that was kind of a game changer from a mental point of view for me and also for my co-founders. So the goal was always, can we actually build a machine that is resistant to what you basically try to prevent as a regulator from a traditional bank? So the perspective to be able to do that and to ship that with a relatively small team, because you don't need a large back office, you don't need an army of risk and compliance people, was always very appealing. So the idea was there for a long time, I would say. The way we ventured slowly into DeFi was first by doing consulting. So we helped DeFi protocols on like quant questions, financial engineering questions, risk management questions. Mm-hmm. Started to build out the code base on the side that ultimately led to D8X, the exchange that is now live on ZKVM. Then saw that the product works out, raised, started to build a team around it, and are now where we currently are.
Okay. So if I heard that correctly, you know, being a part of a big, major global financial institution, you guys have a lot of compliance and regs and rules that you all have to follow. And your protocol. And do you go D8X? Is that how you guys say it?
Correct.
D8X. Yeah, D8X. So everyone go check out D8X. But the that protocol is meant to, I guess, innovate on sort of traditional compliance regulatory processes around, like, what specifically? Like, I know it is a futures-based product, but do you have other areas that you're thinking about this for too, or?
We do. For now, the product that is live is basically perpetual futures. It's the most traded derivative product in crypto, which is basically futures without expiry dates. And you have a different mechanism that ties the price of the future to spot. You don't have an expiry, so you don't have arbitrage, but you have the concept of funding rate, which basically, if the price of the future is above spot, long pays short and vice versa. And that's a perpetual mechanism that always ties future price to spot price. Now, that product is simply the most traded product in crypto markets, so it was a natural beginning. Now, the beauty about that, the way you can implement that on, for example, Ethereum or any EVM, you can do that in a way that doesn't need a middleman, right? So you can mm-hmm. implement it in a way that is fully decentralized, which means that from a regulatory point of view, the same risk, same rules type of principle do not really apply. That's very much jurisdiction specific, but you have some regulators out there which I believe understand how DeFi works, and understand that you cannot simply use the same rule set that you use to regulate traditional finance, basically regulate the middleman, for a protocol which does not have a middleman. So the goal was always to build it in a way that has advantages in terms of overhead. So no middleman, no control function needed, because nobody can cheat you as a middleman, right? So if you think about a large part of traditional banking, like the workforce employed in traditional banking is precisely doing that, right? They are looking that the middleman doesn't do something which he shouldn't, right? So if mm-hmm. you code that from the start in, you don't have to do that.
Interesting. Okay. What was I thinking? I had it and then just totally lost it. I promise I'm paying attention. I just like blanked. What was it? I was curious about, well, we can go this way too. So you're building this protocol to kind of mitigate, I guess, essentially counterparty risk, right? So get rid of that middleman. How like if you are like a traditional, you know, if you're on a trade desk at UBS trading futures, like what would the incentive be for the firm UBS to, you know, move down this road? I mean, obviously maybe you save money on, you know, all your employees, but you know, I mean, I guess is a goal to innovate away a lot of this, like these compliance departments, I guess.
So as from like UBS, you might not have the biggest incentive to do that, because to some extent you cannibalize yourself, right? Yeah. What we've seen, or what I've seen looking at Europe and Switzerland, is that you have traditional banks that enter the space for retail customers. So you have, for example, actually quite surprised, but there are a few Swiss banks, even state-owned Swiss banks, that recently entered for retail clients spot markets. So they allow trading spot for cryptocurrencies for, like, the last one was like last week, PostFinance. It's like 2.5 million retail clients in Switzerland, not super big, but state-owned. Those guys open spot markets for their retail clients. Now, the next step I personally think will happen is that you see the same for derivative markets. So you have retail-focused banks that offer their clients not just spot, but also derivatives. And there, one simple way to do it, and that's one of the theses behind the venture we've built, is to use white-label products. All the banks I know always use white-label products. They rarely develop stuff from scratch. And that's why we built the exchange that we currently have, completely decentralized, completely on-chain, but we offer white-label solutions to tap into that. So, for example, as a bank, you could use our APIs or the user interface kits we developed to ultimately offer to retail customers that as a trading option. So that's one way of how I could envision that the bank could potentially use that. I don't think it's particularly realistic to see that in the next few months, especially not in a jurisdiction like the States. But I do think it's realistic to see that in Europe.
I can't imagine we're going to get a white labeled futures trading platform for like Bank of America clients.
probably not tomorrow. I was really surprised by how fast some of these Swiss banks have been moving to even to spot markets, right? So you can trade crypto, like digital assets, out of your retail account. I didn't think that happens so quickly. And it's not just Europe. You also see that in Brazil. You have like one of the largest Brazilian banks that announced that last December. So you see that at quite a few places. And I think that will continue. The US seems to be not participating. But let's see. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, nothing is going to happen here in the States until we get through this election. I'm curious to see what will happen from a policy perspective. I had on a policy person for my first podcast of the year. They actually posted today. And she is of the opinion, her name's Gabriela Kuz, she's of the opinion that stablecoins will be the first thing that we touch here in the U.S., which I could see stablecoins much sooner than white-label futures trading platform. So, but that's, it's an interesting model, basically, to be able to white label it and just plug it in as, you know, a SaaS product, essentially, into their existing platforms.
We tailor that not just to like traditional organizations, just to be clear. So you can white label that also if you're like in decentralized finance. Let's say you have a decentralized spot exchange, you would like to offer perpetual futures to your clients, you can do the same. Or if you, you can play with that. That's the beauty about decentralized finance. There's a lot of interconnections that are possible. So for example, let's say you develop options, you would like a place to hedge yourself. You can do that on chain on the exchange that we implemented in a non-permissionless way. You just can trade out of smart contracts, interact with our smart contracts and do that. So we have a bunch of options that are tailored towards, let's say, more DeFi native organizations. And we have a bunch of options that ultimately are open to also traditional organizations.
Gotcha. So the users that you have leveraging the protocol right now, are most of them, I guess, what percentage, I guess, are DeFi natives versus maybe TradFi associated?
Right now, the large majority is DeFi native, by far the large majority. I think building that out towards more traditional companies takes time. We work with some brokers that are at the intersection between like centralized brokers, but they do have a crypto lag. So there are synergies that I see happening rather sooner than later. But to actually reach like a Swiss bank, it's going to take some time.
For sure. And then of the people, like of the DeFi native crowd, are they all just kind of trading their own wallets, or would you say that they're DeFi hedge funds and money managers? Like what is your average, I guess, kind of user look like?
Let me just take a step back. We are live on CKVM mainnet. That's Polygon's new CK proof layer 2 solution. And we are live since not very much. I mean, we were live basically since a month. So we are public beta phase. So right now, most of the traders are retail traders that are trying out the product, that are trying out also Polygon's scaling solution. We do have protocols that are currently integrating to hedge. So basically other DeFi projects that need to hedge on-chain their books for whatever reason. They are integrating right now, but the integrations will only go live in the next weeks. So as of today, the large majority of traders are retail people testing out a new DeFi product on chain. Okay. We are working with more centralized brokers to bring their white label solutions live, and that will happen throughout the year.
Okay. Interesting. And what I guess has been the just like starting the business and getting it off the ground. How long has this been? Like from when you left UBS to really starting to work on the project. Like what's the time frame been?
Like full time, exclusively on the DX, a bit more than a year, I would say. My co-founders started before that, working on the code base itself. So I think the financial math to set up the exchange, we started in like end 21-ish.
Oh, wow.
But that's just like from a quant point of view, how to actually set up the model that allows us to set up the exchange. But full time, I would say January last year.
Okay. And it's a relatively small team right now. Like how many people do you have on it full time?
We are full time 8 people. So small team.
Wow. That's crazy.
That's crazy. But the beauty about it is so you can be much more efficient if you can set up a proper decentralized system because you don't need a backend. I mean, you don't need really a back office that validates stuff. So you can rationalize away a lot of the aspects that make TradFi so bloated. So in order to settle a lot of trades, if your system is implemented in a decentralized way and you have a blockchain that acts kind of as a settlement layer, if you want, you can do that with a relatively small team. So the largest decentralized perpetual future exchange right now that is out there, DYDX, those guys, they had a very small team and grew very big. So that's, I would say, a key difference that I always find striking when I talk to people that have a more traditional background. It's difficult to grasp that you can actually programmatically do a lot with a really small team. So that's what I personally like about it. So
yeah. This is kind of into the weeds a little bit, but when you said settlement, it got me thinking about like the TradFi side of the house. So what are there any sort of like inherent conflicts with like KYC and just like client information, you know, those things that you've got to consider in building something like this?
Yes, there are. So the way we approach that is relatively simple. So we built a complete permissionless system that is on the blockchain. Anybody can access that. And then on top of that, we built white label solutions that organizations, white label partners can use. Now, depending on where that white label partner sits and what his existing clients are, KYC questions are asked differently. So you might be a white label partner that sits somewhere in Europe, has your European retail clients. You might want to set up a KYC system on your side as well, right?
Got it.
And on the other side of that spectrum, you might be somebody who trades on-chain, doesn't even need a front-end, a user interface to interact with the smart contracts, and does that from another smart contract. You don't need KYC, right? So the way we think about that is you have a decentralized, permissionless protocol that allows you to settle trades, to place trades and settle trades. And then you have different tools that allow you to access that. And there, the KYC approach comes into play, but that's mainly on our white label partner side, and not on on us as.
That makes sense. That's I guess that'd be an elegant way to kind of build the platform. Like if you still need something fully decentralized, it's always there. But if you are, say, UBS, and you do plug your protocol in, then you can layer in KYC for, you know, all the regulators.
I mean, I'm happy to talk to Sergio just in case, you know, he's listening to your podcast. But yeah, exactly. So you can also build that out further. So you have by default, you have like liquidity pools that allow trading. So you basically, the way the system works is you can trade in different collaterals. Collaterals are what we call pool specific. So let's say you have a US stablecoin as collateral, and you can trade all perpetuals in that US stablecoin pool. Now, by default, those pools are open to anybody who wants to trade in there. Mm-hmm. What we could also support are kind of private pools. So let's say you as a traditional organization could spin up your own pool, and you could control who can access that and who can trade in there. So you can build on that.
Yeah, because you hear about like these, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you hear about these like dark pools that like JP Morgan or any of the big banks will trade through, where basically they're just matching counterparties internally for privacy, it sounds like. Yeah. Is that kind of where you're going, or?
That's an analogy you can use, yeah. I mean, that could be one model that might make sense for some organizations that would like to use such an infrastructure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you guys are up and off the ground. Like, what does the rest of the year look like for you guys? What are you trying to accomplish in 2024?
Scale. So we want to scale. Yeah. That means basically two things. That means on the chains we are already live, add more markets, add more white label partners, and ultimately grow the liquidity such that both items can happen. And it also means going to different blockchains, supporting different blockchains. So we are OKX, one of the largest centralized crypto exchanges, are about to launch their layer 2 solution called X1. We are on testnet right now, and we'll be going live when they go live on mainnet, which is likely end of March. So there's a lot of scaling to do, there's a lot of iteration on the product as well. So one of the user experiences in crypto is this wallet interaction, right? So if you interact with Web3 products, you use wallets, which is often a showstopper for people that are not in that space. So we are looking at that quite closely and see what we can do there. So there are improvements on the product side in terms of user experience, going to a more, let's say, traditional Web2 type of model. That's definitely something we are working on. And we are looking at expansions of the product itself, so going from perpetual futures to a second product as well. So there are, I would say, these are the key focuses right now.
Interesting, okay. I think it's interesting you pulled up like the wallet example and the user interface piece, because I think undoubtedly for like someone like my wife, for example, like if you set her up with a MetaMask wallet and then asked her to send $10, you know, to me, right, it would be a very scary thing for her, particularly once you like increase in size, right? So the fact that all the reasons, you know, I guess maybe native crypto people like are willing to accept that trade, sovereignty and control and all that other stuff. Like for normal people, the fact that you can send, you know, to some random address and have no recourse whatsoever and it's gone forever is, I think, challenging. Maybe can you expand a little bit more on like the wallet piece, particularly for your business? Like, how do you guys think about, you know, interacting with clients and sort of streamlining that process?
So, I think there are two points. So personally, I like the wallet experience because it gives me a lot of control over my assets, right? So I have the keys to them, I can move them. So that for me is a plus. But as you said, I mean, it's difficult for many people and it's a huge barrier. So, you have solutions that try to solve that, account abstraction, and social login features to these type of wallets are out there. So what we definitely will do is we keep the classical way, but we give clients and white label partners the option of what they want to use. So on top of a normal, let's say, MetaMask wallet workflow, you can use social logins. It creates the wallet in the background. You can, let's say, you use your email. You log in with your email, like you log into, I don't know, Google. the wallet is created in the background. You don't see the private key if you don't want to. You don't see your wallet address if you don't need to. And you basically can use that on the exchange. You just need to deposit funds into the wallet that has been created by that workflow. But otherwise, you don't care about key management and stuff like that. So this simplifies user experience. Now you can take that to the next level. You can give that, you can bake that into a system of an existing centralized broker that has, let's say, a working broker app that people use and download from the App Store, fiat connected. You can link those two systems. So we are working into those two directions, giving people the choice, like retail users the choice to either use Web3 wallets or use a social login version of a Web3 wallet. That's step one. And step two is to connect centralized brokerage apps of a broker we are working with to the exchange.
Okay. So in that scenario, what happens to the private key? Like, are you outsourcing the private key maybe to your broker and they manage that access for you if you want it? Or...
correct.
I mean, the private key.
In the second case, that would be the broker. But if you are anyway trading on an app, let's say you have one of the brokerage apps installed on your phone, your funds are in the custody of that broker. So that broker would simply offer the technical support for you to be able to trade on that platform. That would be an example of how a decentralized system could work with a centralized access, right? So that's one example. For the light version of that, where you simply have social recovery, that depends on the technical solution that we take. But there are different options out there. We will not invent that from scratch. Other platforms are using it as well. But essentially, what you do is you create a new wallet, you link that to the social logins you use when you log in, and the private key obviously exists somewhere. You have some security set up that protects that private key, distributed on some network, but there we will not build that from scratch. So there are existing solutions that do that.
Yeah. So basically, the idea is more or less just outsource the private key so that people still have that wallet functionality, but don't have to worry about the private
key. You put it kind of in the background. You don't make it so self-managed, and you simplify to some extent the user experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I've said this on prior podcasts, but I think it's kind of odd that crypto, air quotes, like expects people to understand all the technology when in basically nothing, no other service do you actually fully know, like what, like my iPhone, I don't really know how this works. Like, same thing with cloud, you know, we don't ask people to understand like how Google Cloud or Microsoft Cloud works.
I agree.
I mean, yeah. So,
I do think it's great to have the option. So it's great. So if you like self custody, if you know how it works, I think it's great to have that option. So I'm convinced that more user friendly approaches and let's say the hardcore self custody approach, they can live side by side, right? As long as you don't block one of them.
Yeah. No. And I mean, I personally think like more education just around this topic of self custody wallet management. Like we don't have any like personal finance education in the United States, like at all. So like you can go take out $100,000 student loan at 18 with like zero training on it. Right. Like they'll just give that to you. So I personally think just like financial education and obviously around crypto and DeFi and what the future looks like is super important. So like I would prefer people to be comfortable, you know, managing their wallets to some degree and maintaining sort of like that ultimate control over what they own. But I think, you know, also, you know, people are people. And I think my best case scenario is we could probably maybe get 10-20% of people, you know, actively using the technology. But most people are going to opt for, you know, the smoother user interface, the easier... Yeah, like,
for sure.
So,
I mean, the option to recover your private key in case you lose it, right? So that's, I think, a necessity for a large majority of people, right? That's why, like, account abstraction approaches to wallet management will help, I believe, together with social logins.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you got the wallet piece. You guys are going to be launching some new products. I mean, what about... I'm just curious as far as like starting this little business when, where do you like looking, I guess, maybe further out, where do you want it to go? Like what is like the grand scheme of things?
So the grand scheme is, connecting a truly decentralized exchange platform to centralized players. So I fundamentally believe that if you look out over the next 2 to 5 years, you will for sure see in Europe, maybe also in Latin America, maybe in the US, I'm not so sure, you will see traditional institutions coming into the space for retail customers, right? And we strongly believe that on a decentralized finance, from a DeFi perspective, you need to have truly decentralized products that can be used by those players. Because if you don't, you will simply end up rebuilding a centralized system, and that's that. So what we want to do is we want to build those solutions. We want to be there, have custom-ready, white-label solutions ready to be picked up, and that's the plan. Now, for that to happen, we need to scale the exchange. So we need to make sure that the exchange, the decentralized exchange on-chain works in a way that can compete with centralized solutions. And we need to make sure that the white-label products we have, so the way you can actually white-label and access the exchange, is compelling for those entrants. And then you have a no-brainer product. As an entrant into the space, you have a simple way, something that you know that you can access and actually go with it.
Yeah,
okay. And you see that on spot, right? So the Swiss banks I mentioned earlier, the guys that now offer spot to retail clients, they do that using a white label approach. Mm-hmm. So they buy in basically a tech solution, and run with that. So we think that this is going to be the same for a lot of DeFi, and we think we build out now basically the link between decentralized exchanges and more centralized players. Yeah. So that's the vision, right? But to get there, it's a lot of scaling, a lot of iterations on the product side. It's also a lot about building out the ecosystem, governing the whole system, launching the token that makes the system ultimately decentralized. So this is all on the roadmap over the next 1 to 2 years.
Gotcha. Okay. And then, I mean, as you guys go to the market and tell this story, what do you feel like reception has been? Like, whether you're talking to big banks or hedge funds or retail traders or whatever, what I guess feedback have you gotten from the market so far?
So we got feedback in the form of funding. So we did a funding round last year, secured our pre-seed funding that worked out quite well in the middle of a bear, which was reassuring. Then we got feedback from players that are actually partially in the decentralized finance space already, but have a more centralized nature. That's generally very positive. So the feedback from the big Swiss banks are we're not there yet, clearly. One feature, for example, is let's say you want to hedge yourself on chain. So you basically have a position you want to hedge yourself using perpetual futures. Many of the existing alternatives, they have, let's say, non-traditional cost structures. So for example, if you have an open perpetual future position, depending on which side of the trade you are, you might either pay funding rate or receive funding rate. Your holding costs very much depend on whether you pay or receive. Now, the way decentralized perps have been implemented so far often ends up you paying independently of which side you are. So you always pay. which makes holding that position open costly and makes hatching difficult. So the product we have are classical, if you can say that, perpetual futures. So one side pays, one side receives. And that's very interesting for people that need to hedge. So if we talk to option protocols that are already in the decentralized finance space and they're currently hedging on other venues where they always pay holding costs, that they are very interested in that solution because that will massively bring down their costs, right? So this type of feedback we are getting, feedback from more traditional institutions, it's always all interesting. And then a bunch of regulatory questions, and then let's explore, right?
So are you the one on the team, I guess, handling most of the regulatory compliance questions, given your background? Yeah.
Yes, but to be fair, my co-founders as well, they have a similar background. So we all have been talking to regulators, but that's one of the things I'm doing.
Yeah. Super exciting talking compliance all day, huh?
Yeah, it's great. but I think it's necessary because, you know, the space is relatively new, right? Especially if you really want to do the next step and you want to ensure that decentralized finance has a place in a larger picture, you need to do that, right? You need to. There's no way around it, right? I mean, you cannot always hide and run, right? That's not what we want to do, right? We want to,
That's a great point. I think eventually you just have to engage with the other side because it's not like the European Union and the U.S. government are going anywhere, you know? they're big established players and they've got a different take. So
absolutely.
You've got to engage, yeah. Do you see like a... I mean, in having these conversations with regulators, what is, I guess, their reception? Like, do they see or feel a need to, like, engage with DeFi? Or is it, like, what is the tone of these conversations? Are they just curious? Or are they actually, like, interested in what it can do?
I think it very much depends on the regulator. But if you talk to some European regulators, they are curious. They often have quite a good grasp as well on what that means, but they often don't know how to deal with that because, I mean, typically those guys, they have been regulating TradFi forever and they are used to the same risk, same rules type of approach, right?
Sure.
But if you have fundamentally different risks, I mean, what do you do? Do you start auditing code? Maybe, right? But so often it's like... I think both the European Union and Switzerland, they have pretty much a view on what means decentralized, right? So you have tons of projects in this space that claim to be decentralized, but ultimately have like an off-chain order book, or they have centralized executions of orders. There are a lot of elements that are central.
Sure.
And if you look at, for example, the European Union and MiCA, they seem to express a view that decentralization also means multiple front ends, so multiple ways for a user to actually interact with the protocol on chain. There seems to be an emerging view on what actually decentralization means, which is good. But then, how do you tackle decentralized protocols? There's often like nothing. I mean, no view.
Who do you call?
it's. But that also makes sense, right? I mean, how if I would be a regulator, what would I do? I probably would audit code, right? I would check, is that protocol really decentralized? Is there a bug? But much more you cannot do, right? I mean, what do you want to do? There's no middleman.
Yeah, I mean, you basically, I guess, just have to audit that the code does what it does and, you know, people can't break it or change underlying smart contracts. That's kind of what my guest Gabby, she was talking about the regulators and how, you know, it's different in each locale. Everyone's got their own sort of quirks. But that being a regulator oftentimes has been very reactionary. Like something happens, and then you go in after the fact and assess consequences, essentially. But the idea, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on how I'm thinking about this, but it seems like if the protocol is set up correctly, then you can be hyper proactive in terms of regulation and compliance so that, you know, ideally these things don't happen. I mean, fraud will always happen. There will always, you know, that's always going to be there. But I guess at least a lot of the older problems that people used to just sort of check the box on and make sure that, like, yes, Ben lives at this address and, you know, this is his income and blah, 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 blah. Interesting. I don't know, I'm just kind of rambling there. So,
yeah, but you know, I mean, I think the space is evolving relatively quickly, and you seem to have jurisdictions, even just in the West, that go different ways. So I'm curious where you land. I really don't know. I mean, let's see. So for the white label partners that we have, they all, for example, on their front ends, for example, they all block U.S. citizens for like legal uncertainty reasons, etc. So this, I don't see that going away anytime soon. But as you said, right, let's wait for the elections and see what happens.
Yeah, you know, being an optimist around politics in the U.S. is a tough thing to be these days. So
I don't do politics anymore, so, you know.
Yeah.
Especially not U.S. ones.
Yeah, it sounds like you're a drug addict or something. Like, I don't do it anymore. I'm clean from politics. So wait, totally separately, In looking up about, just doing some research for the podcast about you guys in the business, I came across an article about where you guys are based in Switzerland being like the hub of crypto in Europe or something. Like there's
Crypto Valley in Zug.
Yeah.
So the Swiss has actually made a smart move. So back in like 18 or so, they kind of had like a framework in place to think about crypto.
Yeah.
And that attracted many different protocols and companies. So you have now a small area around a city called Zug, where you have a lot of the big foundations. You have Ethereum Foundation and others which are there. And you have also many protocols. Like we have our offices at the software company we're working at has the offices in Zug. One of the nice things is that you can actually, if you talk to like people at the state there, you can pay taxes in crypto, you can pay taxes in Bitcoin or stable coins. So there's like an understanding of how that works, and that helps for setting up an industry like that. So you have people that don't look strangely at you if you come with like transactions on chain for accounting purposes and stuff like that. So that is useful. So the Switzerland for some reason got kind of an early head start. I feel they're losing right now compared to other jurisdictions that are catching up. But the ecosystem is still quite relatively big and interesting, and you have interesting projects there. So for us, it was kind of a no-brainer. We are Swiss-based, good place to be.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in terms of like the projects and the things that I guess you just probably meet people at a bar and they're doing some thing in crypto.
Kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, Switzerland is tiny, right? So if you're living in the U.S., Switzerland is like really tiny. We're like not even 10 million people. So it's like tiny, tiny. Then you have like the sub-regions and but it's good. Good place to be.
Yeah. I mean, what have you ran into that's also interesting? Like, totally separate from what you guys do, but what are some projects and people you know who are doing cool things?
There's a lot. I mean, I'm looking around in DeFi. I see a lot of really cool things being built, from restaking Eigenlayer projects to new primitives, new markets that you can build out from scratch. Which I mean, there are. I've been looking at impermanent loss and markets for impermanent loss, and that there are like very interesting concepts floating around. But I, even like, you know, like from a non-technical point of view, I see like Bitcoin ATMs in Switzerland. You walk around, you see that. It's kind of, you know, interesting. It's not a game changer. I personally would not. I mean, I don't use them, but yeah, it's, sure, it's an interesting fact, right? To see that. No, but I mean, for me, the most interesting part is really being able to build these machines and interoperate them between each other. So that's fantastic, right? So we have met so many protocols that can use DIADEX as a venue. For example, let's say you build out a stable coin, you can integrate a pool on DIADEX, people can trade using your stable coin on DIADEX. There are many interactions possible, which is what I like about that space a lot. And I'm very curious to see where we stand in like 5 years from now.
Is Switzerland, I guess, like sort of the hub of crypto in Europe right now? I know London's got a big scene, right?
London is big. Portugal also has a big scene. Switzerland used to be very big. They have, so if you think about tokenization, for example, tokenization of shares of small and medium-sized firms, for example. Switzerland has established a legal framework that allows to do that. And you have different startups that are currently trying to do that. So they really tokenize the shares of your, you know, like average small company. So this is something that where I would say Switzerland is leading. But you have other European jurisdictions, Portugal, London, that are also doing their fair share of moving the industry forward, I would say.
I actually got invited to a conference in London from a guest. I will not be going. It's too far. I've got a daughter.
Too far. Fair enough.
I don't know. I mean, as you know, like everything is just incredibly busy once you've got a little one. And
So not so much traveling.
No. It's a lot easier to hop on a Zoom call and just do it this way than in person.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Maybe some fun stuff. Like what are you most interested in about for this year? Like for the market as a whole? Like are there any things that you think are going to be big themes in terms of just where crypto goes in 24?
So one thing I looked out for a while now is, given you have relatively high interest rates, right? Many of the yield bearing products in crypto have lost, relatively speaking, a lot of attractivity, right? So the liquid staking and liquid restaking developments are about to change that. So this is something I'm very curious to see. So the interaction between LRTs and other DeFi protocols and what that makes to basically the risk-free yield in crypto, or whatever that exactly is, right?
Yeah.
So that's something I'm following quite closely, and this I think we see a lot of changes there going forward. So that's one topic, and the second topic, I mean, of course, like general market sentiment. Where do we go? Or, I mean, crypto people like cycles, economists like cycles as well. But where we are there, what happens? I mean, right now the past few months have been very positive, so I generally have kind of a positive outlook going forward. But so these are the overall market sentiment is making it positive, right?
Where do you think we generally are in the cycle? Like my quick take is, I don't know how the U.S. seems to be levitating in like a okay place. I would have thought that interest rates backing up as fast as they did would have created some kind of a train wreck, but it hasn't happened yet. Like, as a quick aside, I mean, real estate where I live in Northern California more or less has stayed the same or gone up, which, you know, for the basic math, I just don't understand. Yeah. I know we have a housing shortage here, but yeah, I don't know. I guess we've weathered this backup in rates a lot better than I would have thought. Yeah. So I'm kind of
same.
I don't know, I guess.
It's tricky. Like, if you look at what the central banks seemed to have achieved, it's crazy. Like, really, can they really engineer soft landing? Maybe, right? I mean, I wouldn't have bet my money on it before, but
yeah.
So that's it, the data I'm seeing looks positive, surprisingly positive. So let's see if they now don't mess up by lowering the rates. So if they actually lower the rates in time and don't mess up by keeping them up for a longer time, they might actually get away with that. So we might end up not having a large recession either in the States or in Europe. But let's see. So for us, like as a business, I think we are kind of to some extent not directly affected by that. So that's we closed fundraising, we are afloat, we have the product going. So but as an economist, it's a very tricky period. It's difficult to say something meaningful. If you look at the predictions from economists at large banks, it's like, what? I'm curious what the Fed is going to do. Honestly, how fast they're going down. I don't envy them for their the decisions they have to do. All the models they use, they don't work right now. I mean, like, if you look, central banks, they have a bunch of different models, right? They used to run projections and they all failed.
Interesting. So give me your unpack that a little bit. So like the general models the Fed uses to sort of look into the future.
I'm not specifically saying the Fed, but central banks in general, right? So they use like large macro models. They have a bunch of them. They all didn't see or didn't predict the increase in inflation post-COVID, right? It's also difficult for a model to see that, right?
In a common sense way, I mean, come on. Like, I don't know where people, like, I'm not an economist. I don't know how they view the world that way. But like, if you just print $2-3 trillion out of nowhere and double the money supply, like, I mean, come on. Like, how hard is that?
The large macro models, any model is limited, right? And then the prediction power of a large macro model, if you have supply shocks and stuff like that, is bad.
Yeah.
Right? Now what they do now, right? So they have live data, so they see data, which helps, right? But from a model point of view, I don't know what they do. I mean, I would actually like to know.
The models don't work.
Works, right? But they didn't work particularly. They were actually quite bad, I would say, over the past few years.
So do you think, I mean, obviously using the data and models, like trying to game theory what the world looks like is helpful, but do you kind of feel like regulators have maybe relied too heavily on the models and sort of not kind of ran things from more practical kind of view? Like what's your kind of take there? Like how should they think about it?
No, I think, I mean, you need models. Models are the best guess you can have, right?
Yeah.
But you need to know the limitations of them. And you need to, so I just maybe side note, at at UBS, what one of my teams did was looking at models. So we looked at models and see how good or better. So they are all bad. They, no model works properly, but some are less bad than others. So having models helps. But that, I mean, it's a model after all, right? It's not reality.
Yeah.
But having model works, I think working with models is the right way to do stuff. But you are limited, and if you're in a let's say extraordinary period where you have stuff that you cannot model that changes, what COVID. Do you do, right? For example, right? A policy decision, some the stuff you cannot model, right? This is like, you can try to account for it, but it's tricky. And now if you try to engineer the landing, I mean, you probably have the same problem again. Because your models... Let's see. That's why I don't envy them.
I mean, the point's not lost on me. Like, I come from a wealth management background, and, like, people love running, like, Monte Carlo analysis on portfolios to try and, like, predict what the price in the future looks like. And sure, it's great to do, you know, but, like, I would work with these advisors in the U.S. who would, you know, want to, like, put a guess at, like, what the price of oil looks like and what interest rates look like and, like, what is Forex and, you know, what are your macros? And it's like, this is like astrology for men. Like, you are not, there's no way you're not going to hit that parlay bet and get interest rates, oil, Forex right. There's no way you're going to get those right. So, like, I don't know.
But definitely interesting time. I'm also curious for like the crypto / digital asset space, where this is heading. I do think there are some larger trends, like the one is like more traditional institutions entering, stuff like that, which I think will continue. But curious where we end up in a few years.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the world's either, I don't know. I feel like with the, you know, crypto kind of took a backseat to AI, which maybe is a good thing. Like, everyone's freaking out about AI right now. But like, the combination of all this technology coming together, I think, is one of the more interesting things that I kind of think about, is like, what do humans do with this? Do we actually create a better world, or do we just blow ourselves up, or like, what does the world look like?
But that's why I am convinced that it's really important to, for example, if you think about crypto, that if you design protocols, you need to design them in the right way. You need to design them in a decentralized way that cannot be tampered or used for fraud purposes, right? So this is I think key, right? And we need to do that now. If you don't do it now, it might be too late. So
the idea around governance and like how decisions are made, I think, is actually really important, because at least like in the States, like, it, not to get into politics, but it appears that like the rules change based on who you are and who you know, right? And that obviously creates like mistrust across the board. So being able to sort of set the rules in stone and make them clear and easy to understand, I think is, I mean, I would argue is really important. Like,
everyone, I fully agree.
Yeah. So,
and you pair that with like transparency, right? So you have clear rules that are transparent. Simple, right? You know that, you know how the game works. You can play it or you don't play it, but at least you know how the game works. And you cannot simply change it, which is great, right? I mean, it's a good start.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably where you have to start. Like, if you don't know what the rules are, then how can you play? But let's see, we're right at about that hour. Anything you want to finish up with, Casper? Where can people follow your work? What you guys are up to?
It's a good place to start on Twitter, @DX_exchange. We also have a Discord server in case you want to interact. Always a good place, LinkedIn in Twitter. And check out DX.exchange.
All right, there we go.
There we go.
Go trade perpetual futures with Casper.
No time. Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thanks, man. We'll talk soon.
Likewise. Yep. Have a great day.